Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Is there a shudder in this reverberation in the microphone tonight? Is it okay? Most of you are probably familiar with the common saying, I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes. And tonight I'd like to put a Buddhist slant on that particular phrase that is in common usage. In that particular phrase, we are crediting our senses with providing us with accurate information about reality, about the things that we see, we hear, we smell, we taste, and we touch, and we think about it, and we think about. And we credit the information that we receive through those senses as being what provides us with the truth, with an accurate picture. I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't heard it with my own ears. Well, the Buddhist slant on that is slightly different. The Buddhist slant on that, according to the Buddha's explanation of our experience, is if I hadn't believed it, I wouldn't have seen it with my own eyes. If I hadn't believed it, I wouldn't have heard it with my own ears. Now, I heard this phrase turned around in this way, not in a Buddhist talk, but when I was reading about the war on terror. And someone was saying how after the terrorist attacks in America in 2001, people were killed because they were suspected to be a threat, suspected to be terrorists. And the first person who was killed was a Sikh man because it was believed that he was one of those people from the Middle East because he had dark hair. He had swarthy skin colour. And he looked suspicious. People were expecting that from someone who had that kind of appearance. And the person who was a Sikh, as you probably all aware, comes from India, not from the Middle East. The other thing which made him look suspicious was he had a beard. And these Muslims have beards, most of them, and so that was another telltale sign. And the person who killed him, who thought he was suspicious, thought that he was doing something good. He was protecting the country from these terrible people. Because he believed these things, what he saw in that person, in their presentation, their physical appearance, what he saw in their behaviour, what he heard in their accent was a threat. And he put two and two together and made seven. This person is a terrorist and I'm doing a good thing by getting rid of him. If I hadn't believed it, I wouldn't have seen it with my own eyes. When he saw what he saw when he heard what he heard, he believed he was interpreting it accurately. And we can say, well, that's just how wrong he was. But the Buddha encourages us to recognize that we're all doing that all the time, that we filter out or filter information through a series of prisms of views and opinions, ideas about things, and that we create a picture of things according to those views and opinions. And the extreme of that, which we can see in just ordinary life, is when someone has delusions, when someone has paranoid thoughts and believes those thoughts and interprets their experience in the light of them. So this week someone called me up and said that she was sure that there were cameras all over her house and that whatever was going on in her house was being put all over the internet. And she was very worried that people were seeing what was going on in her family. And not only that, that the television was giving her messages. What she was seeing on the television was meant specifically for her, telling her what to do. And she believed that, and so she was living in fear. Because she believed it, she was seeing those messages, she was hearing those voices, and she was believing what her mind was telling her. Again, this is an extreme example, but the Buddha said this is what we're doing all the time. We are creating our own world, each one of us, again and again and again, through the way that we interpret what it is that we receive through the senses. In reality, when the physical eye sees an object, it only sees a shape and a colour. And it's the mind which interprets that shape and that colour as being a particular thing. And it not only interprets it, but it reacts to it. There's the identification of it, which we call perception, but there's the pleasant or unpleasant feeling that goes along with it, which is another part of the mind called Vedana. When we see an object and we don't see the whole object because it's obscured, because we don't look at it closely, if it's something that we're familiar with, the mind completes that object based on what it expects that object to be, what it assumes that object to be. So, for example, in our cutlery drawer at home, we've got our knives and our forks, and we expect our knives and forks to be in the drawer. Whenever we open the drawer, it's the cutlery drawer, and so, of course, knives and forks are in there. We don't look every time we open it to make sure that it is the knife and the fork that we're seeing. We're so familiar with it that we take a glance in there and we complete the picture that that's what it is. And because it's the cutlery drawer and we open it so many times and we've opened it so many times in the past and it's just the cutlery drawer, then there's no strong feeling of whether it's pleasant or unpleasant to open the cutlery drawer and see the knives and forks in there. It's a very neutral kind of feeling. Now, if someone puts something in the cutlery drawer that we don't expect, then we may open the drawer, look in it, take out the cutlery, and still not recognise that anything is in there, and then we went, hey, what was that? And then we take another look. We weren't actually paying attention. We've just worked on our previous experience of that drawer and our expectation of what it is that's in there. if someone were to tell us that there is the knives and forks in there, that's what's usually in there, but 1 in 100 times when you open the drawer, there's a venomous snake in there. Most of the time when you open it, you'll only find the knives and forks. But every once in a while, it's possible that you're going to meet something that could hurt you. And if we just reflect on that, we will notice immediately the whole experience of opening the drawer, dealing with those familiar objects, becomes quite different. When we go to the drawer before we even open it in anticipation of opening the drawer, could this be the time when the snake's in there? And we already feel an unpleasant feeling. Quite different from that neutral feeling of just opening the same old drawer with the same old things in there. And when we open the drawer, we're not going to just stick our hand in and take what we expect to be there without having a good look first. We might even open the drawer very slowly. And when we look in there, we're going to look at every item and take it in to see exactly what it is. And when we look in there with that kind of attention and that kind of detail, then we feel that we're getting an accurate picture of what's in the drawer. We're not just going on our assumptions. This gives you an idea of the difference in our understanding of the experience of any moment, how it is coloured, not by the objects so much as by our reactions. And how when we go through our ordinary life, so much of what we know about a situation, so much of what we assume about people that we're meeting, so much of what we project into the future is based on assumptions, based on prejudices, based on jumping to conclusions, based on seeing part of the picture, based on our beliefs. If I hadn't believed it, I wouldn't have seen it with my own eyes. Now, the reason why this is so important for us to be aware of is because we do jump to conclusions. We do make assumptions. And in many areas of our life, we never recognise that that's what we're doing. We never know that we're bringing the past with us into this moment, and it's the past that is dictating our reaction to this event, to this person, to this situation. We think we're choosing. We think we're in charge. We think we're directing our life, but in fact, it's our habit patterns and our conditionings that are directing us. Remembering that it's not only what we think about the thing or the situation, but how we feel about it. If we have this gut reaction of, I don't like this, it's unpleasant, then that's going to propel us into speech and action to get rid of that feeling somehow. If our reaction is based on something that's been pleasant, then when that pleasant feeling arises in the present, we're going to want to keep that, to get it again, to make it grow. And we get pushed along by our feelings about things, as well as our thoughts about things. And this limits the choices that we can make in any situation. Because we're not seeing things with fresh eyes, because we're not open to all the possibilities that a situation holds, we just go along in our own old limited way. Now, some of those limitations, our past conditioning, might be useful. They might actually help us to make a decision. They might be relevant in the present moment, but they also may not be. They might be outdated. They might have been relevant once, but not now. They might actually cut off some of our options. Now, recently someone was talking to me who, because of an illness, finds themselves quite weak and debilitated at the moment. Their body just can't do the things that they used to be able to do. It's even difficult sometimes to get out of bed. Sometimes it's difficult to stand up. Sometimes it's difficult to prepare food. All of the basic things in life that we can so easily take for granted. Now, when I was talking to them about their situation, one of the comments that they made to me was, "I'm not going to be like a disabled person." And just that kind of attitude in the mind is a very good example of what I'm speaking about tonight, of how our ideas about something can actually prejudice us from seeing something with fresh eyes and making use of all the options and opportunities that we have available to deal with situations that we find ourselves in. Now, how is that applicable to this kind of situation, this kind of statement? Well, the idea of "I'm not going to be like a disabled person." First of all, there's a sense of what is a disabled person? There's an image there, obviously some kind of negative image about being disabled. Now, one of the things that we reflect on again and again is that all of us are only temporarily abled. None of us has a body that's guaranteed to be fit and strong until it ceases. And in fact, even if we just get older, this body is going to slowly but inevitably get slower, weaker, less resilient, less energetic, all of those things. So this perception, this idea that somehow there is this abled and then disabled state, and that I reject the disabled state, is based on an assumption. Now, in the Buddha's teaching, we are encouraged again and again to recognize impermanence, change. But the Buddha said one of the prisms through which we filter our experience is that we hold up what is impermanent to be permanent. Again and again and again, we reject that whole idea. We reject the reality of the fact that change is happening moment by moment to everything around us, to everyone around us. And when we reject that, we have to keep fighting against it. If we open up to it, the truth of change, the truth of impermanence, then yes, this is impermanent. When the body gets sick, when the body gets weak, what else can you expect? This is what happens. And the idea that we are either abled or disabled, and that disabled is something negative, ceases to be one of those prejudices. We're variously abled and variously disabled, and we could be at any place on the line between being fit, well, healthy, strong, able to do whatever we want to do, and not being able to do much. Now, when we don't reflect on even this basic fact of life and challenge our assumptions,
challenge our attitudes as we encounter them, distorting reality again and again as we go through our life. When we come to a difficulty, like, yes, we have an illness, yes, we have a body that's breaking down, yes, I can't do things that I used to be able to do, then we have this concept of disabled, and I'm not going to be that way, and anyone who wants to help me, who wants to treat me as disabled, is somehow an enemy. We're fighting against the facts of the situation, the reality of the situation. Can't we accept this is the body right now? The body needs help now. The body can't do now. And it may never be able to do again in the way that it used to. So that's the nature of this body. It's incredible how we can be exposed to impermanence throughout the course of our life and get to 50 or 60 or 70 or older and still not be willing to accept it, not be willing to look at it, to filter our experiences through that prism, that delusion which says, not me, not my body. And yet this is something which we do to our suffering. One of the other prisms that we filter our experience through is the prism of self. This is mine, this is me. And what is me, what is mine? Particularly this body. I won't give in. I won't admit it. I'm not going to let this beat me. And we might say, well, that's a very positive attitude. And it can be. But it can also limit our willingness to see things as they really are, to accept our limitations, and to be able to make use of the help and the resources that are available to us. The idea of self around the body is the idea that we can make this body do what we want because we're in charge of it. And throughout the course of our life, we keep getting the message, no, this body belongs to nature. It follows its own rules. The slightest cold, toothache, earache, the fact that our hair falls out, the fact that our hair changes colour, the fact that wrinkles arrive on the face and then all over the body. These are all examples, these are all warning signs saying, hey, wake up. You think this body is you, you think this body belongs to you, but that's not right. There are certain things you can do to help it, there are certain things you can do to support it, but ultimately this body belongs to nature. And when we don't accept it, when we believe that it's mine, that it's me, then the cold, the aches, the wrinkles, all of those things become a problem. Because it's me that's wrinkled. It's me that's weak. It's me that's old. And it becomes suffering. For the person whose body is breaking down, their body may never again in this life be as strong as it was before. They may not be able to be fully independent again in this life. Now, if we can start to slowly, gradually come to terms with that, how much more peace of mind there can be? How much more mental energy can go into making the best use of what we can do, rather than just concentrating on what we've lost? People who do have chronic pain, or people who do lose use of their body, very often the way that they practice in order to muster the maximum strength to get through their day and to use what they've got is that they make it a practice to allow the mind to dwell on those parts of the body that are pain-free, those parts of the body that do work well. Someone said to me once that as they examined their body, they found that the only place that was pain-free was their armpits. And so they put their attention on their armpits and they said, actually, when I put my attention on my armpits, it was nice and cool there. And so they were able to give their mind that boost rather than to dwell on all the parts that were aching, all the parts that weren't working. And this is a skill that we need to practice. If we don't start to wake up to the realities of this body, when we still have the mental capacity to do that, it becomes very difficult later on when we may find that we're challenged beyond what we can cope with. We have to develop these strategies while we've got something that we can manage as the problem in front of us, while we have the opportunity to repeat it again and again so it becomes something which the mind can easily do. It's like the athlete. The athlete trains for months, for years, before the big race. They don't wait until they're in the middle of the race and then try to do the work that's necessary to perform well. And so if we don't take the opportunities as we go through our life, then we may find ourselves cornered, nowhere to run. We can't run. The body's not working. We can't get up and go somewhere else. We can't go and do something more pleasant. We can't get out of this skin. And so we look at our belief system about the body. And every time we notice ourselves going, oh no, not another. Oh, what a disappointment. Oh, look at that. Or we can't do what we want or whatever. We listen to that voice which is crying out against reality. And then we remind ourselves, hey, this is the truth. This is the nature of the body. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to nature. The other thing that we do in filtering out our ideas about things, particularly about this body, is that we see beauty in things which aren't really beautiful. And again, if we think about this body, so much of our disappointment comes when the reality of aging starts to be indisputable. We can't hide the bits that are falling down, the bits that are sagging, the bits that are lumpy, the bits that aren't there anymore, that used to be our pride and joy. Over time, we start to see these things. And again, we can reflect on how deluded we were in the beginning when we saw our bodies when they were young, when they were fresh, when they were beautiful. They looked beautiful because we only looked at the surface. We didn't really appreciate that all the time we were seeing that beauty inside, underneath, there were all sorts of processes going on which are miraculous, no doubt, but which are yucky in their essence. All the things that come into the body that we take in to nourish this body, to make it beautiful, to give it our glossy hair, to give it our shiny skin, to do all those things to make it beautiful, they all pass out of the body as waste products. Either we breathe them out or we excrete them as urine or feces. Temporarily, it seems that it's beautiful. The food, the delicious food, the wonderful food that goes in. And when it produces the glossy hair or the shiny eyes or whatever it is that we admire, we appreciate those things, but we don't allow the mind to dwell on what's going on in the body itself, how all of those things are being turned into usable items and the rest is being excreted as waste. So we only look on the surface, and then as the body gets older, that surface beauty slowly disappears. And we might say, well, just the fact that the body's working then becomes our source of beauty. We see the beauty of the body because it keeps on going. And again, we're only seeing what we want to see, because as well as processing all of those things that we're putting into the body to produce the beauty, we know that all of those processes are gradually grinding down, ceasing to function as well as they did, no longer doing the job that they were doing as well as they were doing it before. And all of those processes are taking us in the direction of old age, decay and death. And if we don't reach old age, it means that this body has ceased to function while we were younger through disease or accident. And so what seems to be beautiful seems to be wonderful. Again, when we look deeper, holds a much more powerful message. It holds the message that it is functioning according to its nature, not according to our wishes, and in ways which are only beautiful when they keep doing the job. Now, these are just some of the ways in which we filter our experience and interpret what we come into contact with, what we see, what we hear, what we smell, what we taste, what we touch, what we think about, how we filter it to create a distorted understanding of life. And those distorted understandings are not just on one level. They are to do with our ideas about things and also our emotional reactions about things. And it's not just one thing at a time. We build up a whole conglomeration, if you like, a whole woven cloth of wrong understandings, wrong interpretations, distorted views, distorted images about all the things in our life. And so it becomes very difficult to isolate where that particular wrong view came from, that particular idea came from. And it becomes difficult sometimes to see how my particular emotional reaction right now is the result of so many different wrong ideas, wrong understandings, wrong perceptions that have been built up over the course of this life. So for the person who's saying, I'm not going to act like a disabled person, there's the idea about who I am. If I'm not a disabled person, then who am I? What is a disabled person? That's a view and opinion. That's an idea. That's an image which gives rise to an emotional reaction which colours the idea that I don't want to be one of those, which colours the idea of what I think a disabled person is capable of and what kind of quality of life they have and what sort of relationships that means they have with the people around them. All of those things are woven into that reaction of, I'm not going to be like a disabled person. All our ideas about the nature of the body and what the body means to me. The person who was talking to me was saying that the level of pain in the body is some way of thinking that death must be near. But that's an idea about death. That's an idea about pain. And putting, making pain equate with death is an idea, is a concept. It's not necessarily true, but it can be so fearful that the person then feels frozen, can't do anything, can't cope with what's the painful situation they're in, because it reminds them of the frailty of this body. It reminds them of the possibility of death. Now again, isn't it amazing that the possibility of death produces fear, when the reality is, all of us, we know that one day we're going to die. Now we can ask ourselves, do I really know that? Do I really believe that? And we can see how our reactions to it can be on many levels. Yes, of course I know that. But am I ready for it? What do I think it's going to be like? How am I going to cope if I am in pain? How am I going to cope if it's a long time between the illness and the death? How am I going to cope with immobility? How am I going to cope with not being able to do the things I used to do? Sometimes we don't want to put the mind onto those kinds of reflections because we somehow feel that we'll bring those things on faster if we think about death, if we think about the fact that this body is fragile. We can notice that kind of reaction in the mind. That is also a learned reaction. That is also a conditioned response. Where did that come from? Who taught me that? Where did I pick that up from? This is the way that we start to question our assumptions and question them in the areas of our life that really do have bearing on how well we can cope with what life has to offer to us. When we can ask these questions of ourselves and we don't have an answer, then we keep on asking. This is what Buddhist practice is about, asking these questions while we've still got the opportunity to understand the answers. And the way that we do that is through cultivating the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path, as most of you would be aware, has three components to it. The wisdom aspect, the aspect which has to do with the direct cultivation of the mind, cultivating the mind to be mindful, to pay attention, to see things without adding on our views and opinions about them, and developing the mind in meditation. And the other aspect of the path is the cultivation of virtue, developing a life based on goodness. Now all of these aspects need to be there so that we're able to see things as they really are, to be in touch with the facts of life, to be able to live more comfortably within the limitations of life. Keeping the precepts, developing goodness, is a way of freeing the mind of so much fear and worry, strengthening the mind through the power of goodness. Sometimes it's difficult to convince people that just by living within the boundaries of the precepts and not harming others deliberately, keeping our commitments, being honest in our speech, not taking what isn't given to us, refraining from using drugs and alcohol, just living within those boundaries already gives the mind so much more peace and strength. And when we develop that peace and strength through mindfulness practice and through meditation practice, we are starting to produce a mind which is capable of investigating our experience and bearing up to the answers that we find when we ask those questions. The reason why we don't see things as they really are is not because it's not obvious. It's because we don't want to see things as they really are. Because we're not strong enough to see things as they really are. We can't bear to see things as they really are. But it's not only a matter of being strong enough. It's a matter of being wise enough. But the wisdom that is able to see things in a completely new way, outside the prism of our distorted views, can only be developed on the foundation of goodness and the clarity that comes through meditation practice. The wisdom isn't just a matter of being able to pay attention. It's being able to pay attention but be free of distortion while we're paying attention. And the distortion, the ultimate distortion, is our self-centered way of looking at whatever it is that we encounter in our life. This is the ultimate distortion. And it's only by practicing persistently over time, again and again, that we start to break down that ultimate delusion. That the mind starts to be able to free itself of those distortions, those distorted ways of looking at things, thinking about things, and the attitude that arises from that. So the strength of mind, the clarity of mind is important, but the freedom of mind is what is the essential ingredient without which we won't be able to penetrate to the truth, to the heart of things. In order to come to that point, we need all of the ingredients of the Noble Eightfold Path. We can't do it without any of them. We can't dispense with virtue and expect that the meditation itself is ever going to get deep enough, clear enough, strong enough, peaceful enough to lift us out of our old way of seeing things. And unless we are lifted out of our old way of seeing things through the mind which is developed in meditation, we're not able to see things freshly. We're not able to see things outside the box of self. And until we do that, we continue to live within the limitations of our distorted view, our habit patterns, and our conditioning. So I encourage all of you, as you go about your daily life, to question your conclusions. The thing that springs to mind immediately as your reaction, the conclusion that you jump to, don't take it as the truth. It may be part of the truth, but it may be distorted as well. The important point of this teaching is to bring up in our mind the constant reflection, uncertain, not sure. How I see this, how I react to this, what I think about this, my view and opinion about it, not sure, uncertain, take another look. This is the way we prepare our mind for death, but it's also the way that we support the mind so that we can live peacefully and happily throughout the course of our life, as we become more in touch with the way things really are. This is for our benefit and also for the benefit of all those with whom we share our life. So may this teaching be of use to all of you, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. If there are any comments or questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them. Right. The question is, in the Noble Eightfold Path, what is the difference between view and thought? Are you meaning right view and right thought in the Noble Eightfold Path, right? These are the two aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path that are to do with wisdom, understanding, and the first one, the right view, is to do with samaditti, is to do with the wisdom of understanding things as they really are. So basically understanding the three characteristics of existence, that everything is impermanent, that nothing has an inherent nature of a self-existing self nature to it, and that when we attach to things which are changing, then there is suffering. Also is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth of life is inherently unsatisfactory. The second noble truth, that the basis of our suffering is our self-centered craving. The third noble truth is the possibility of freedom from suffering, enlightenment. And the fourth noble truth is the truth of the Noble Eightfold Path itself. Also in right view is the understanding of what is called dependent arising, paticca samuppada, which means that everything arises out of a cause, and every cause produces an effect, and that effect becomes a new cause. So these are basic aspects of the wisdom part. Now the right thought, samasankappa, is translated as right intention or right aspiration. And these are the kinds of thoughts, the Buddha said, that are heading in the right direction towards enlightenment. They're the ones that we should cultivate and that the enlightened being lives with permanently all the time. So it's the thought of renunciation, of giving up, the thought of loving kindness, and the thought of non-cruelty or compassion. So that is the right intention, samasankappa, on the Noble Eightfold Path.
And could you explain it to me, if there is any karma without dharma when there is children concerned?
Right. I'm not sure whether I've understood the question correctly, so you can tell me if I've understood it correctly. The question was to do with children being administered mind-altering drugs as psychiatric treatment or because of disabilities, and that someone had said that there's maybe some karma in there. So the question is about what is the teaching on that.
Yes.
Is that the question?
Yes.
Okay. So The question, the teaching on karma is the teaching which is also a part of the wisdom aspect of the path, right view, is to understand, as I said, that things are produced by causes and conditions. They don't arise out of without causes, and they don't arise just because of one cause. Everything that arises, like the person's view and opinion about disability, arises out of multiple causes and conditions. That is, experiences they've had, what someone has told them, what they've seen for themselves, their ideas about being healthy or not healthy. So things, even thoughts and ideas, arise out of multiple causes and conditions. Now, in the law in karma, we're talking about the effect that is produced by conscious mental intention. And in the law of karma, when one has a conscious mental intention to think, to say or to do something, then one produces karma. The action is called karma, and the effect is called karma vipaka, the fruit of that action. Now, if the intention was a wholesome one, that is one that was for supporting, for helping, out of kindness, whatever, one that doesn't harm oneself or others, that's what's considered to be wholesome, then the fruit of that action will be happiness. Happiness in that moment and also happiness in the future, which can ripen in this life, can ripen later in this life or in future lives. If one intentionally thinks, speaks or acts in a way which is harmful to oneself or others, then one produces an unwholesome karma which fruits in unhappiness, either immediately. And if we are hurting ourselves, there's unhappiness in the moment. If we're hurting others also, there has to be negativity in the mind to do that. And also that may fruit later in this life or in future lives. So all of us are making karma every time we intentionally think, speak and act. We've made karma throughout this life. And in the Buddhist teaching, we've made karma in the past. Some of the karma that we've made in the past, in this life itself, may not have fruited fully yet. Some of the karma that we've made in past lives may be fruiting in this life itself. And so when we see people who are suffering, or when we're suffering ourselves, and we examine why it is that we're suffering, we might see, well, there's no explanation for anything that I've done in this life. And the Buddhist explanation is that there may be a reason from a previous life. We've done something unskillful, we've done something that's hurtful, and we are receiving the fruit of that now because the conditions are right this time for that karma to ripen, for that fruit to ripen. So this is not something that is just for people who are in great difficulty. This is for all of us. So when we see anyone suffering, the Buddhist understanding is to have compassion, because we recognise that we're all bound by the same laws of karma, that we also are bound by the laws of karma, that we can at any time receive the fruits of good karma or bad karma, depending on the conditions that are existing in our life at this time. So if we see someone who's suffering, then we don't judge that person as being bad or less or worse because of that suffering. We recognise that this is the nature of life. And if it's possible to do something to help that suffering, to ease that person's suffering in the moment, then we do what we can. The question again is about karma and dharma. The teaching comes after, because karma is part of reality. So the Buddha's teaching is an explanation of reality. The karma is reality. It's existing whether the Buddha comes along and teaches or not. It's something that the Buddha is pointing out. And the path of practice which the Buddha points out is the prescription for the illness. But the illness is there whether the prescription is given and whether we take the medicine or not. So in that sense, you can, if you're using dharma in the sense of the Buddha's teaching, you can say that karma is there first and the dharma comes later. But dharma is also used in the sense, when you see it in books written down, as a small d, which relates to reality. And reality precedes the Buddha's teaching, because reality is, and the Buddha's teaching comes afterwards to explain that reality, and not only to explain the reality, but to give us instructions on how to understand reality, to work with it, and to move away from suffering. If a child, we're making karma, well, over there's intention, so it's not a matter of being judged. It's, this is a law such as, if you like, the law of gravity. The law of gravity is, and we don't judge that the law of gravity is, should be or shouldn't be, or is we like it sometimes and we don't like it others, it is. And so whenever we come to the point where we are intentionally making a thought, speech and action, then we're making karma. I think this will be the last question. The question is, did the Buddha teach his words for enlightenment to all beings who mightn't have heard it? The understanding that we have is that this isn't the only life that we've had. We've probably all heard the Buddha's words at various times throughout the cycle of birth and death, and we've taken up the practice to various degrees. We've heard the words, we may not have put them into practice. When we're looking just at one lifetime, it can be very difficult to work out what seems to be unfair, what seems to be giving everyone the same opportunities. So the law of karma and the understanding of karma really only makes sense if you think of it over more than one lifetime. But the way that we see its validity is to see how it plays itself out in our own life. Once we become aware of the law of karma, once we become aware of the fact that when we think, speak and act out of wholesomeness, then happiness follows, we investigate that to see whether it's true. When we hear the teaching that when we think, speak and act out of unskillfulness, then unhappiness follows, we say, okay, let me take a look at that. We investigate it. So none of these teachings have to be believed just because you've read them, that was the Buddha's words, or you've heard someone talk about them. This is something that we can and that we should investigate for ourselves. So if we look at suffering in others, we can't understand it, if we only look at this life, it becomes very difficult to fathom it. But if we expand our consciousness to think in terms of more than one life, then it becomes more understandable. And if we look at our own life in the present moment, what do we know of karma through our own experience, then it also starts to become something that we can investigate and know for ourselves rather than just depending on the word of the teachers. Okay. So I think we've probably had enough questions now. It's after 9 o'clock, so I'd like to invite Sol to make any announcements.